Hey, are you tired of meeting with prospects only to have them put you off again and again, turning them into yet another missed opportunity? Are you tired of trying to do the same things in meetings and not seeing any improvement in the amount of business you're closing? Do you want to stop giving your time away in hopes that a client will buy something or someday transfer their assets? Well, Whiteboard University is our two-hour live workshop where we will teach you how to have engaging meetings with every prospect and client you meet with, how to quantify your advice so prospects are willing and excited to pay you a financial planning fee, and finally, where we teach you how to explain financial strategies in a dynamic, interesting way that will separate you from all the boring advisors who do the same old thing. If you're serious about having better client meetings and closing business faster, visit WhiteboardU.com today and sign up for one of our live workshops in November. Whiteboard University offers a 100% money-back guarantee if we don't help you improve your communication and meeting skills. That's WhiteboardU.com. We'll see you there. Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Becoming an Elite Financial Advisor. I am your usual host, Andy Traub, and I'm here with my friend, member of the Elite Advisor Network, and an all-around great guy, Tim Dyer. Tim, thanks for being on the show, man.
Well, Andy, I got to say, it's a pleasure to be here. A lot to do out here in San Diego, California, but there's no other way I'd rather spend a Thursday morning than with you, bud.
That's right. That's right. Good way to start your day, even though I've already had my lunch. So let's talk about the time zone difference. You've always been a Californian. You've always been this laid back guy to me. I don't know how much of that is California, how much of that is you or
did Well, surprisingly, my journey starts. I was born in Boston and grew up in the southernmost part of New Hampshire in a town called Nashua. My mom was a flight attendant. She flew for Eastern Airlines, if anybody remembers that. And so as a kid, we used to come out to California a lot in the winter, and her, I used to call them fly gals. I don't know if you can say that anymore, but her friends in the industry, a lot of them lived in San Diego. And so we would come out in the winter and it was all fun things, right? Disneyland and SeaWorld.
Living your best life as a 13-year-old boy hanging out to fly.
Oh, yeah. Even younger and all through that.
Yeah.
And then they'd come out and come out to Cape Cod and Maine beaches and stuff in the summer. And so when I got out of business school in 98.
Where was that?
I went to a small business school called Babson in Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Okay.
A lot of focus on entrepreneurship, and there's some good stories that come out of there for sure. One of them being one of my classmates is the guy that founded Ring Doorbell. So he's in all your homes.
I literally have a Ring Doorbell notification on my phone right now, if you look at it. So yeah. Is he the one that sold? Didn't they sell to Amazon?
Yeah, they did. They did. Yeah.
But they were within Shark Tank and didn't get funded. Is that their story?
Yeah, Jamie Siminoff's the CEO. He's a really great guy. And he's one of those guys that you knew, like, if I don't know if we in our yearbook had like chance to succeed, but he was by far and away one of those guys, because you talk about a quick start, a guy that could take an idea and move. Yeah. But he was an early participant on that show Shark Tank. And he was kind of one of the first guys, I think, that went in there knowing his numbers, knowing he didn't need them and for the publicity. But it still goes down in history, I think, as one of the biggest mistakes that the Shark Tanks, the Sharks passed up on. So interesting story out of Babson. But, you know, we were talking about how I ended up here. There was sort of a few events that happened. One, I was familiar with San Diego. My roommate at the time was like, let's go out and hang out on the beach for the summer, cool off some steam. We'd both been playing college sports, and we were just sort of looking to take a little break, and we didn't have our exact career lined up. But I had an inclination that I was going to go into finance. My uncle was a pension manager for Eastern Airlines, so you can start connecting some dots here how that came about. But, when I came out here, but before I moved out, I actually got injured my senior year playing lacrosse, and I came out on spring break. The whole team was going down, and I was like, and I just had knee surgery. I'm like, I got to get out of here. So on the flight out to California, I just happened to be sitting next to a gentleman that worked for Prudential Securities, which was the sort of investment trading division of Prudential, not the insurance side, but underneath that umbrella.
Okay.
And he was coming back from Italy, so the last thing he wanted to do was talk to me. But I had mentioned that I was having an interview while I was out there at Prudential's, and he just happened to work at that branch. So you can coincidence is remarkable. And I had set up that interview because somebody that I'd known through the Alumni Association at college was like, there's a Prudential branch in San Diego. You should go talk to him. So I set up this. I mean, it just all kind of came together wildly. Anyways, so that's how I got here. I started my business in what you call the wirehouse side.
Did you get that job?
I did get the job. I did get the job.
All right.
Well, I got to tell you this one other story, though. So I've never, you know, I'm on the West Coast. I've never been like a early morning person. I've always sort of gotten up early, but I'm not that person. It's like, yay, let's get up at 5 and ready to run a marathon. Like, I need coffee and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I mentioned that because the interview was at, you know, they said, be at the office at 6:30. And I'd love to say I operate on Lombardi time a little bit better, but I'm known to be late. So I'm like, okay, I can't screw this up. So I got to the office at like 5:30 or something, you know?
Yeah. And it was 2 hours later in your internal, or 4 hours later in your internal clock, right? So you were.
Yeah. Yeah. There was some of that. But we were operating on the West Coast schedule probably the night before. I get to the office and the door is we're in this high rise building, but the door is bolted up, or, you know, locked. There's nobody there. And I'm sitting out in front in my cheap suit, you know, probably at the time. And finally, like, one of the receptionists shows up at like 6:01 and she's just like, who are you? I'm like, well, I'm here for an interview with so-and-so. She's like, okay. And just opens the door and leaves. Like, doesn't say like where to go or anything. So then the brokers start funneling in literally at like 6:20. They sit down and then they immediately go downstairs to get coffee. And I'm like, well, let me just blend in. So I kind of, you know, shuffle in the elevator with all these advisors. I go down the elevator. We go to the coffee cart. I you know, whatever they ordered, I ordered. And I'm just standing around and nobody asked questions or anything. And I remember one of the guys reading the Wall Street Journal. So I pick up the Wall Street Journal and he says to his other buddy, like, oh, I can't believe the Dow Jones closed at 7,887 or something. And I actually think that was the number. So I should go back and look at a chart.
Yeah.
But so I get in my interview and my manager, this was a hardcore guy from New York, you know, born and raised in New York City, real trader kind of stock guy. And he just looks at me and doesn't say a word for like 5 minutes. And I'm like, all right, I've heard that these interviews are tough. And then he goes, well, the Dow Jones closed at last night. I'm like, well, I think it was 7,887. He punches in his Quotron, you know, and it's like, well, he kind of looks at me like, interesting. And so again, you know, the irony of how this all happened was kind of interesting. But
That's cool. Yeah, my word for that's serendipity. In part because it's a John Cusack movie that I liked. But
sure,
of many that I've liked of his. So you've been in the business how many years then?
I got licensed in 1998. You had to get a Series 7 back then working for a major brokerage firm, which gave you the ability to get, you made commissions on sales back then, which is what a Series 7 is needed for. And back then it was, okay, you take the test in 2 months, study on your own time, cold call until then, you take the test on a Friday. If you fail, don't come back Monday.
Do you remember how much you passed by or?
Yeah, I do. I got an 86. You need a 70 to pass. And so I kind of went in there with my chin high, breaking my arm, patting myself on the back. And everybody kind of threw rotten tomatoes at me and said, you study too hard. You could have been cold calling more because you only needed a 70. So that's how it was back then. Yeah.
Nothing's never good enough. Can't just be happy for a guy. Come on, fella.
Right, right.
Well, maybe you need to go back and thank that guy who was talking about the Wall Street Journal. So let me ask you this, as we talk more about your career, and where, you know, you've intersected with Lead Advisor Network. One of the things that I find, unique about you is your willingness to try stuff. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, we overlap in some trying different, you know, studying different marketers and just that entrepreneurism. And I think that we've both been around it long enough to be tired of most of it, but there's still some good stuff in there.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I've noticed about you in the time I've known you for a few years is now that you you're willing to try things. And I want you to just maybe speak to those who are younger and older, but specifically older, that are finding themselves just a little bored. Maybe financially okay, but just sort of sure. bored. And how your willingness to try things has, in many ways, reinvigorated your enjoyment of what you do for a living.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You mentioned sort of this quick start mentality, and I'd love to take that and run with it. But, you know, my Colby would say the opposite. For those of you who don't know, the Colby exam kind of says how you tackle projects. And I'm like a 9, 8, 4, 2 or something like that. So that means I'm a fact finder. I actually do a bit of research before I do things, but I do use that in the intention to, you know, act on it. I think as far as the business goes, the reason that has come to be is because, you know, not that I was like a black sheep or a purple cow or anything like that, but I knew out of necessity, like I didn't have a big network. I mean, I had a good upbringing, but I didn't have this big, you know, network to tap into, if you will, when I started in the business right out of school, right? And so I had to, I didn't have like big CPA connections or estate planning connections, which many people didn't, right? If you started in this industry right out of college. And so I had to figure out ways to grow, you know, and I'm just sort of looking around at people that had done things before. And that's kind of a big part of things I've learned now, you know, do not take advice from people that haven't accomplished what you're looking to accomplish, no matter how heartfelt it might be. You really need to find the person that that sat in the seat. So I'll tell you, you know, we're spending a little bit of time in my early history in the brokerage world, but I remember, so I went through training and it was .com era back then. So people were interested in talking about stocks and whatnot. And you know, I was having some success opening accounts and whatnot on stock ideas that the firm was providing. But when I got back from training, after what it was 6 or 12 months after you'd kind of made it, you know, half the guys flush out there after the first 6 months and then the other half after a year. But I started interviewing the guys in the corner office, right? And back then it was kind of a closed door deal. People, the senior guys would just go into their office, they'd close the door and do whatever. But I would, you know, kind of rub elbows with the guys around the coffee cooler or the water cooler. But I remember asking this one guy who was the biggest broker in the office. And I said, you know, look, I'm out of training. He goes, yeah, I see that you're, you know, kind of an up and comer or whatnot. And I said, look, you know, I'd like to get ahead of it and start building the right foundational skills and activities. And he says, look, Tim, it's really simple. He goes, just never leave the firm. Just stay here. When all the advisors fail out or die or move to another firm, you just take all their accounts and off you go. Now, as somebody that paid a fair share of money for a business degree in entrepreneurship and finance, that was probably like the most deflating thing I'd ever heard, you know, because part of the adventure is like you envision that when you've created what you want to create, that you're proud of it, but that you realize like I created it, you know, like I created the outcome and the journey's part of it. But man, oh man, that like really soured me, you know. I was like, God, I'm not gonna do that. Like, it's not that I wanted success faster, but I wanted to, you know, be in control of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to have a business that was reactive, where you had 3,000 clients and you just were coming in and putting out whatever fire there was in the day. I wanted to be out in front of things, and then, you know, there's always some fire putting out, but
yeah, it feels like that what you wanted was, I want to be a part of something where I've got to go hunt, find it, get it, and I can claim it. And he was saying more like, actually, it's more like hide and go seek. Just hide. And as people get found and or quit, just stay hiding. Just, it's like, just outlast them, but don't outwit them, don't outsmart them, just don't leave. And I appreciate you saying that, because I don't know that there's nothing about that that is, you know, be more strategic, be more unique, be more creative, be, you know, be willing to do the hard things. Like, just don't quit is not very motivating, right? You know, another day where I'm not going to quit. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's not a great mantra. I haven't seen that on a poster with an eagle. You know, you didn't quit today, you know?
Right.
So what was your transition? So that was deflating. When did you figure out, like, that's not going to be my path? My path to success is not going to be just because I don't quit. It's going to be because I'm doing things. What were those things that you were doing other than not quitting? Because obviously you're still in the game.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. These are sort of those, linchpin moments, or as Seth Godin says. So the first was after a few years at Prudential. Remember, that was in the dot-com era, right? So we rode that momentum and all the growth and wealth creation that was coming out of the NASDAQ and those tech stocks. And then it crashed, right? And I said to myself, well, listen, I don't want to be building a business that goes up and crashes, goes up and crashes around the stock market. And so I, got some additional training where I was doing some more in-depth portfolio management stuff, which kind of overlapped with what my uncle had taught me about stocks and some things like that. And I mentioned that because at the time, Payne Weber had a program. It was called PMP, and Portfolio Management Program. And so I was one of the few guys back then that was actually managing discretionary portfolios. Most people were coming in, they're filling out a questionnaire with the client, putting it in a computer, it was spitting out a pie chart, and then they were saying, you need to have, these mutual funds to fit in this pie chart.
Yeah.
And I just says, there's a little more to that. And it's funny because even back then, that was novel for the client. They thought that was, acceptable. Now with the internet, everybody's like, look, you could press a button and do that yourself. But long story short, I started managing portfolios at Payne Weber. And, I was probably the only guy in the region that was really doing this full time. It was like a pure money manager. Now I bring that up because after, .com, the next one was the Great Financial Crisis, which was 2008. It actually started 2007, which was the peak. We went through 2008 and then it bottomed out in 2009. But there was a moment there, I'm managing these portfolios. And I mentioned the start in June because some of the strategies that I was running, I had kind of a growth strategy, an income strategy, and then a stable strategies, just to kind of oversimplify it. But our growth model was starting to get more conservative, even though the market was still kind of ticking a little bit higher. And so it was raising cash. So the regional director calls me up and he says, Dyer, we need to talk to you. Need you to come up to Los Angeles. I said, oh, this is great. This is my moment. He's going to say, we recognize that you've got a business that's growing aggressively. We're going to have you train some of the newer, younger guys underneath you. And there can be some foot soldiers that can open some doors. And then I can come in and talk about it or do presentations and whatnot. And we'll just, off we go. So I get up to LA and I'm in this, it's almost out of like a comedy movie. There's this long conference table and he's at one end, I'm at the other. And I'm like, here we go. Like, what's this bonus package going to look like? And he says, Dyer, I'm sorry, but we can't, you've got 20% in cash in your accounts and we legally can't charge, we can't bill on that money. So since we can't bill on it, you're going to have to get that money invested tomorrow or you're not getting paid. My regular advisory fee. I'm like, I just sat in traffic for 4 hours for that.
I just drove 10 miles in 4 hours in LA for that.
So back then, back then you didn't have the range of ETFs where you could sort of park money that's conservative or funds. It was a more limited inventory of things. And so I called a few clients and said, look, I can set up these separate accounts. I can move the cash into that. And then we can do a capital call and move it back. And they're like, you know what, Tim, just whatever you think is best. And that's right there was that moment where it was time for me to just go on my own and build the vision that I'd had for, the first 10 years of my career, if you will.
Is it because you felt like someone above you was essentially disagreeing with how you were handling things? Then you went to the client and you said, hey, I want to do something. And they're like, whatever, I trust you. So did you at that point say, I'm not going to do what they told me to do. I'm going to go do my own thing. Mm-hmm. There's a reason I had them in cash.
Yeah, part of it is like, again, I was sitting in a middle seat and I'm serving the client on one hand, and I'm serving the firm on the other hand. I'm sitting in the middle, and there's like a, you know, there's a little conflict to that, right?
Yeah.
I got to put food on the table, and you know, for my family and whatnot. And so, you know, I've got to get paid by the firm, but I've got to do right by the client. You know, and so again, that sounds a little.
It seems like an impossible situation, though, in that they created pressure where there didn't need to be, right? But maybe that's maybe that's how their model worked, and you went, okay, I want to try a different model. So, how long into your career did you say, I want to make Dyer Wealth Management?
It was 98 when I started, and it was literally 8/8 of 08 when I, you know, packed up the box and walked out of the building. So, you know, it was about 10 years.
How far was the crisis into the crisis in 8/8/08?
We were right in the middle of it. You know, if you can imagine that, remember that CNN video where like the guy's like, oh, there's no, it's a peaceful protest. And there's like a huge building on fire behind you. Like that, when I walked out the building at UBS, like that is what it was like. The financial collapse was like a full throttle. UBS was in, by the way, I mentioned UBS, but UBS acquired Payne Webber, like right when I moved over there.
Wow. So you're in the middle of the collapse, and you go say, I want to go do my own
thing. And so there's one other thing too. So that I was disappointed that the firm was sort of, you know, misaligned, but the other thing that it opened my eyes to was that the client didn't care, right? That's where you sort of got that validation that the client looked at Tim Dyer and said, you know, we trust you, we're in you know, Camp Tim, guide us, lead us. And and just coming into the business in that brokerage world right at school, there's still that sort of people are with me because I'm at this firm and they trust me. You know, it was like it originally felt combined, right? But then you realize like they don't care what the label is on the front door if you're doing a good job. And so the last part of that is, you know, I could have just created something and appeased the boss, and the client, you know, probably wouldn't have been that much worse off, if you will. But like, I actually, and I'll just say it, like, I actually give a shit, you know, like I actually really cared. Again, it sounds like virtual signaling, but it is a part of the thing. Like, I wanted them to do well. And I always thought that like, if I do really well by the client, for the client, then, you know, it'll come back to me. And I always believed that it's now proved itself out, but I'm not sure everybody did originally. It was just sort of like, hey, you know, give them what's good enough, and as long as I don't have to worry about it too much. And so I don't know.
Let me ask you about the tension then, or the, I mean, maybe tension is not the right word. That's a negative word. Tell me about the reality of, you know, you're a wealth manager, not a stockbroker, right? Tell me about the reality. Tell me about the reality of, you by nature, from what I know of you, and we've talked for hours and hours and hours in different settings about different things, are a generally a happy person, an optimistic, a joyful. And again, I might just be California, I don't know. But you know, it might be the San Diego vibes, I'm not sure. But what is it that you would encourage others to consider? Because you're not the kind of guy that's going to tell someone what to do, but it's, hey, consider this. What would you tell other people to consider if they want to live well, make good money, but also take some risks in this business?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. The first thing I would do is ask them to, you know, or if we were having this discussion, you and I would, I'd sort of invite you to challenge like what you believe. Like, what, you know, what do you believe, whether it's from a business perspective, from a client perspective, you know, what are the hills that you're willing to die on and what are the ones that you're not, right? So that then you start to get a little bit clear about, you know, who you are. The other thing is you have to reverse engineer your desired outcome. Tim Ferriss, a big influence back in the day, you know, 4-hour work week and all that stuff. And it wasn't just like, hey, I just want to work 4 hours. It was like, how do we do this stuff way more efficient? Because everybody does everything they can to see what sticks. And then they create this mess that at the end, it takes them years to unwind. I mean, you wouldn't imagine the amount of advisors I know, colleagues of mine that we've been in the business and around, you know, about the same amount of time. And they're stuck in these businesses that they just can't unwind. They've got so many clients. They just, you know, the income is, you know, good.
But it's a trap.
It's a trap.
And, it's a well-funded box you can't get out of.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you have to really start with the end in mind. What do you want it to look like? And it's as nuanced as like, do you want, you know, what does your morning look like? What do you have for breakfast? What, you know, how long is your commute? Do you go to an air conditioned office or do you, you know, kind of work remote or something like that? And so, you know, then you realize once you figure it out that then you start living it. You know, I mean, I'm up early. I've got two young boys, 5 and 3. I'm up early, you know, wrestling around with those guys. I do some work at the house, you know, from 6:30 to 8:30. You know, we do breakfast as a family and whatnot. And then I get in, my day starts here. I live just down the street here in La Jolla from my office. But, you know, my day starts meetings at 9 and off we go. And you might say, well, don't start till 9. Well, no, I start earlier, but I'm really efficient with my time, you know, and so I think that's part of it. I will say this is when it comes to risk taking, a lot of times, you know, I could just say the usual platitudes like, listen, just go do it and make mistakes and learn.
Burn the ships, right? Yeah.
All that. Yeah. Burn the ships. I do like that. It is true. Sometimes you need to do that.
Right.
But the other thing is, you know, there were some things I could have done before I left and went independent. And I was sort of ready to just go and take the risk and this and that. But
that's what most people do. Most people go, I'm tired of this. And they just go, you know,
rip the Band-Aid. Yeah. Yeah. And so, again, as somebody that's done that, to add to that, take some more calculated preparation. You know, what are some things, what are some contingency plans that you might not be thinking about that you could think about? You know, a myriad of different things. I could have, you know, created some better spreadsheets of some of the information before I left or whatnot. Just so when I got there, I was hitting the ground running instead of saying, I got to get out of this. Let me get over here and I'll start from the ground up. Like you can build some of those if we're talking about moving around, but you can build those things, you know, while you're rating. So you call it piloting, right? You're running too.
I appreciate the, and again, it's start with the end in mind, but there is something about this industry. And again, we can say this in our spot as EAN, because we get to talk with advisors from all over the country and all different companies and independents, so on and so forth and even those who are independent, they're not outside of this. Sometimes people go independent and they do the same thing they would have done working in a company. Mm-hmm. Meaning they think insurance is the only way to go, or someone thinks AUM is the only way to go. And, you know, build your own life. That's fine. But I love what you said about, like, decide what hill you're going to die on, right? And then maybe question, is that really true? Is that really the hill I want to die on, or is it the one that someone told me to go die on? And so that's why I'm so stuck on it, right?
Yeah,
because I'm sure there's people from your past who said, you know, Tim, you can't do that. You can't charge people for your time. You know, just, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I there's room in the industry to do it different ways. I'm not saying have to do it our way or Tim's way or whatever. But I do think that people just find themselves, it's going to sound silly, but I think it's true. Most people find themselves where they just sort of find themselves, meaning there was a very lack of intentionality about where you end up. Where are you? You know, I guess I'm here. Why? I don't know, but I'm here. And the great thing about, if you're intentional about it, is that today you can choose a different destination. And my favorite analogy of this is in Dumb and Dumber, when Jeff Daniels falls asleep and Jim Carrey's driving and he drives 4 hours in the wrong direction. And he's so proud of himself. He's like, I didn't want to wake you up. And he's like, have that line, John Denver is full of whatever. They're not in Colorado. But, you know, there's activity. And then there's purposeful activity. And Jim Carrey was active for 4 hours while Jeff Daniels slept, and they drove in the wrong direction. So there's a lot of people who are just, they're on autopilot. And I think it's because there's enough money in the industry that you can be on autopilot and making good money or growing your business.
Right.
And you find yourself saying, crap, this is what I grew. Dang it, you know? So what are a few things that you would encourage people to ask themselves that maybe they're not thinking about asking themselves? I mean, you touched on a couple, I think, that I liked, which is, how long do I want my commute to be? Right? Mm-hmm. How do I want to be remote or in person? What time do I want to start my day? What would you say to someone who is, you know, they're all in on insurance, right? Or they're all in on AUM, or they're all in on fees, when it comes to a balance of those to consider? I'm not saying that the ultimate goal is 30-30-30, or, you know, like they're even distributing yeah. them. But what would you say to someone who is in a specific camp? Because I feel like you do a good job of living in all of those worlds of fees, AUM, and insurance.
Yeah, if I understand your question, I mean, you're asking, like, from a business operation perspective, like,
yeah.
if somebody's primarily
focused, how do you decide which one you want to go into, or how open should they be to saying, you know, why take three? Why take one when you could have three?
Yeah.
Or fully say, no, it's okay to be an AUM guy, but, you know, be all in. How do you help people question their beliefs, not because they need to change them, but because maybe they need to confirm that they're true? Because I think something you've done well is you've tried different stuff, right?
Yeah.
So how do you test that and not, you know, lose your job?
Well, I think on the first part, we're under the assumption that if you're operating in a certain, you know, track, we're using the term assets under management, which means, you know, your primary business is focusing on managing investments.
Yeah.
We're talking about this track of insurance where you're working for a agency or a captive, as we call it, and, you know, like Northwestern Mutual, yeah. and you're in that, or New York Life, and you're in that, and your primary focus is on insurance products and things like that. Well, look, I mean, if you're looking to, you know, change your environment, then you have to be open to what different areas are. The other thing is that we didn't cover about that is asking your clients, you know, if you've got a certain type of clientele, whether they're retirees, corporate executives, business owners, you know, what services are we providing that you like, and which ones are we missing? There's been moments in my career where clients have done something, and I'm like, why didn't you talk to me about that? And they say, well, we didn't know you do that. Okay, well, we're not going to make that mistake again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, some of those things come to mind. I think, because I'm running what you'd call like a lifestyle or boutique practice, right? And what that means to me is that, you know, I'm the lead advisor. I'm working with the limited number of families. We never really operate with more than 100 families, but some of them are planning specific. But I would say on a consistent basis, we have between 60 and 70 families that we work with. They tend to have a little bit higher net worth, kind of in that
sweet
spot.
A lot of people listening would like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And it's whatever, 25-year overnight success. But
but walk people towards that path.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I'll sort of break it down. I mean, I've got the clients, the average net worth is, or average investable assets with us is about 2 million. And there's a range of net worths that go with that. But we're doing, from a wealth management perspective, you know, planning on the front end, then we're doing in-house investment management for them. And then sort of coordinating as their quarterback outside.
Yeah.
Strategic networks, right? And I mention it from that perspective because when you think of it all under that umbrella of wealth management, some people just operate under the planning silo. Some people operate under the investment silo. Some people under insurance silo. And, you know, I'm sort of a blending of those. And it took a little while to sort of, because let me backtrack a little bit. One of my early mentors, a guy named Jason Wink, you know, you might have heard of him. He founded a massive RIA called Retirement Wealth Advisors. He went on to found a massive money management company called Formula Folio. And then he went on to found Altruist, right? The new custodian that's going with against Schwab and Fidelity. But I was at an early mastermind group of his years ago, and most of the guys were insurance guys that were there, and women, and they were sort of interlapped in working with these, what is called an FMO, these marketing agencies, and I'm like, what is going on here? These sort of historically boring, you know, insurance guys. I'm sorry if I offend anybody out there. But they're doing this really cutting edge marketing stuff. And I was like, wow, you know, how is this happening? And that's where I got exposed to insurance, because I was really interested in the marketing part of things. But I started to work and network with these insurance professionals, and I learned a lot about, you know, how they talk to business owners and what's in, you know, what they're discovering from that perspective, just to use that. And then I said, well, geez, you know, that would help my business owners. And maybe the solution was a insurance solution. Maybe it was a investment solution. But I now had both arrows and I didn't care either way, you know.
Right.
I now had the knowledge. And then, you know, you start bringing in estate planning. And then now more recently, really deeper on the tax stuff. And you can add a wealth of knowledge and really have some impact. And, you know, the fact that we can control the clientele, the number of it, my business survives whether or not we add another client or not, you know. And so that's an empowering place to be. So a little bit all over the place there, but.
No, that's great. It's great. I think what's important to remember from that is that there's many ways in which, if you're in the industry, you know, they call it the golden handcuffs, but you become, you're not in charge. You feel like you're in charge, but you feel stuck by your success. Like I can't move. And this isn't about leaving the company. It's about who you want to be as an advisor. We work with companies that are full on legacy, and people would say they're boring, they're not going to change. Nope. They are embracing planning. They're bringing us out and paying us a lot of money to teach your advisors, who then turn around in the next week, start selling plans like that. And so it's not about leaving the company or staying in the company. It's about what kind of advisor do you want to be? And I appreciate your story and who you are as a person, because I think that, you know, you're a lot of things, but one of them that I think is you do think for yourself. You are willing to take risks and survive. And maybe one of the reasons that you not just survive, but you can thrive and enjoy what you're doing, is because you don't take huge risks that are going to bankrupt you. But you also, I think of you as, and this is a compliment, I promise. So hear the whole thing before you curse at me.
Yeah.
I find you to be childlike in your sort of like, oh, that's interesting. Like things are interesting to you. You're not judgmental, like I have all the answers and yes, I already know enough. You're more like, you're like willfully ignorant. You're like, I don't know.
Oh my God.
Sounds interesting. I think
Danny, it drives my wife crazy. I can't go anywhere without asking somebody a question. Like, you know, you're in the airport and you know, you see somebody like, oh, what's that hat mean? You know? And they're like, wow, what? She's my wife. Why would you ask them that? I'm like, the hat looks interesting. I don't know what that logo is. You know,
I'm interested. Yeah.
You know?
Curiosity.
And it's genuine. I mean,
I think that if you want to grow, I think that how do you grow without being curious? And so again, we want to be practical. I love hearing these stories, but I think the practical measure of you talked about a lot of practical things, but one of them is if you feel stuck, then it's probably because you're not being curious enough about other options. You know, open your mind to there are other ways, and I could maybe choose one of those ways. I think that you've done a good job all the way back to getting talked to across the 30-foot table and saying, you know, but what if I didn't have to say yes, sir? What if I said, no, sir, I'm going to do something else? And so I hope those who have listened today are encouraged by your story, because you tried a lot of different stuff and I think you still are very hungry for new ideas. And the advisors that we talk to that have been in the business for 20 years and longer that like what they do is because they're still doing new things. Like,
sure,
they figured out a lot about what they're doing, but they're also willing to continue to experiment. They're sort of childlike in their interest of things. Like, they're always looking for something new. And I think that that's where it's scary, but I think that's where you can continue to find happiness in the industry that often is not, if you ask, describe the financial service industry, like happiness is not in the top 10, but it should be. It can be a great business, right? I'll give you the last word. What else do you want to share with
me? Well, you know, what I was going to say is, so we're talking a little bit about like ego, right? I've been around long enough where I could like, whatever, I could check that at the door. In fact, it's more fun being humble and self, you know, deprecating. But
yes, it is.
Years ago, I had an intern who ended up becoming a full-time employee, and she was getting her CFP at San Diego State. Her name is Chelsea. And it's funny because I'm like, oh, you can get your CFP like in college now? You know, we had to do it after the fact,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But she was working and I was doing a lot of investment management stuff. And she says, well, you know, why don't you look at the tax return? I'm like, why would you look at the tax return? Like,
she said that to you?
Yeah. This is a while ago. And you know, she's listening to Michael Kitsis in The Office. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, come on, that's the geeky guy with the blue shirt. You know, Michael Kitsis is a great guy. But I'm like, come on, you know, and everybody's sort of pushing this planning thing around. I'm like, look, planning is taking a yellow notepad and sitting and listening to the clients, right? And look, I was totally wrong about that. And again, this goes back a little bit longer. So she opened my eyes to these things and she says, look, let me do this. Let me do that. And I just gave her some more stuff. And then, you know, I started learning. It walked me into, you know, this out of my comfort zone into that knowledge and learning zone. Right. And I'm like, wow, I'm, you know, cause we used to do the investment management and then add in sort of financial planning things around it as value adds.
Did you charge separately for them?
No, back then, no. It was like that was making the investment assets, right. You know, adding our value to the whole process. But EAN hit me, you know, at the perfect time, the perfect place, because this is where I'm like, man, I need to flip this on its head. Like this, the value part is a lot of it is in this initial planning work. And I think now I've sort of broken it down into two different areas. And people ask, what's planning? I mean, I've got this sort of light version and I've got this more comprehensive version. Because if you were to take a spreadsheet and say, look, these are all the things that are incorporated in financial planning, I would argue that these are all the things that could be, you know, talked about in financial planning. But for a lot of people, you know, these particular things, you know, meet or solve their needs.
Yeah.
For other people, it's more comprehensive. You know, you're getting real deep into all the insurance policies and optimizing and this and that. But, you know, anyways.
But a lot of now, them are covered by a simple version, right, is what you're saying. And so you're open to planning and you're doing it more often and you're enjoying it.
So when I got engaged with EAN, you know, you guys had that program, HDC, you know, How to Charge, which was... you know, just sort of some of the logistics around how you go to on the front end. See, before it was sort of like show them the movie to sell them the popcorn, right?
Yeah.
Now it's just like, look, let's just talk about the entire experience and say, is this something that you want to be a part of, right? And it, what's the magic of it is that it's allowed me to actually serve more people. So clients that maybe didn't meet my, you know, typical assets, I don't really have minimums, but we kind of have a minimum annual fee. For people that didn't meet that, I could help them with my 25 years of knowledge.
Yeah.
And really put somebody on a which was fulfilling for me and, you know, 10x value for them, right?
Yeah.
I could do those plans and, you know, and for other people that before that might have had a larger portfolio to need help with, we could put that on the back burner, get all those foundational things covered. And then if they want our help to manage the assets going forward, we can do that.
Yeah.
I'll finish with this one last thing on the topic is that in the investment space, you know, the old, okay, here's your portfolio. Here's our portfolio. You know, this has got lower risk, better return potentially, right? That's a pretty commoditized argument, right? And even if you're right, and look, we add value in our portfolios, but if we make a couple percent more in our portfolio than you do, okay, that's got a little bit of impact. But if we save you, you know, 20-30% of your tax bill, and then we do that over a 10 or 20 year period, just for example, and then we save you 40% on an estate bill, which, you know, down the road is gonna come due.
Yeah.
Those are real numbers, right? That's the stuff that really moves the needles. And you need to do that planning exercise to vet and uncover those things. And it's just not something that you can just say, here's, you know, let's run a commercial on the Super Bowl and say, this is it. This is what it costs. This is what you get. It's nuanced for each person. So that took a little while kind of getting ramped up on how to kind of describe it. But I've never had people on the investment management side say? They say, well, I don't want to deal with this, Tim. You know, can you? Well, when it comes to the planning side, after those meetings, people are saying, this is what I've been looking for. This is exactly what I've been looking for. And nobody knew how to describe it, right?
Interesting.
The public and then the professions don't bridge that gap very well. So we're working on it collectively.
Well, yeah, we are. We are working on it. And we appreciate working with you. Appreciate your implementation. Appreciate how you've been an advocate and a spokesperson for EAN in many ways. And I appreciate the way you continue to add value to our community. You know, really, community's mostly only as good as its members. And I think we have a great community in large part.
Very good community. Yeah.
So thanks for being a part of our community. Thanks for your time today.
Good.
And I wish you continued success over at your company. And look forward to coming out and visit you in La Jolla sometime.
Due diligence trip, right? La Jolla, right here in La Jolla, California. In Bird Rock. Yeah, come on down. The ocean's right behind this wall. So yeah, we're very fortunate. It's a nice area. But I've been to your area. It's a nice area.
It is nice. It's a little
warmer.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim.
Right on. Okay, buddy.